think someone asked you about this before. It will be as hard for you as it was for us, but just a few books. Would you talk about just a few influential books in your life that you'd recommend?
Sure. Edward Said. No. I noticed that the books have now been cleared away, but I did notice that Herman Selderhouse's new biography of Calvin was on the bookstand outside. I read that just last week. People are always asking, what's the best introduction to the life of Calvin? And Herman Selderhouse's new book, published by InterVarsity Press, is probably the best scholarly introduction. When I say scholarly, I don't mean to put people off by saying that. I think it's scholarly but very accessible. I would suggest that that's the best thing to get hold of to read on Calvin. And I think reiterate the Affirmation of Christianity and Liberalism. It's a very important book. And also, just in case people were not aware of this, it is about to be re-released by Erdmans in a new, they're retypesetting it, new preface, and a photographic section as well. They agreed to do it as part of the 80th anniversary celebrations for Westminster Seminary. So there's a new, you may want to hold off buying it for just a month, because there's a new edition coming out in May that will be hopefully aesthetically much nicer to own.
Did you write the preface? Who wrote the preface?
I wrote the preface. I didn't know.
Yeah. Well, you should read that. That'll be good stuff. I was going to say Christianity and Liberalism too, and I was also going to affirm D.G. Hart's biography of J. Gresham Machen was why I went to Westminster. To me, I tell students it's a model of what a book should be. It's just a very, very well-written book. And, you know, just a hugely entertaining and important figure. Probably something off the beaten track, but someone I've recommended a lot, Wendell Berry, who is a Kentucky poet, essayist, farmer, has written a number of novels and short stories about a particular place, Port William, Kentucky, there's a lot of wonderful insight for the importance of community and ultimately the importance of membership in a community that translates quite nicely to life in the church. And so the novel that particularly is moving that I usually recommend as a starting point is a novel called Jaber Crow. Jaber Crow is the town barber, and so he knows everyone quite intimately, and it's a good way of learning all the characters in the story. So something more serious, Machen, but also Jaber Crow by Wendell Berry.
I would add one more as well that just come to mind. D.A. Carson's book, Memoirs of an Ordinary Pastor, was published probably about a year ago. It's a very short book, and it's just his own reflections on his father, who was a pastor in French-speaking Canada in the, I suppose, the latter half of the 20th century. I think it's an important book. One, it's a very moving book because it's a book that only a son could write about a father. But secondly, I think it captures more accurately what is the experience of most of us in the church. I mean, I belong to a church of maybe 70 or 80 people, meets on a Sunday morning. Carson's father's church may have been even smaller than that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's much more akin to, it's ordinary, as the title suggests, and it describes what ordinary church life is like for most people, as opposed to the glamorous biographies of the great and the good that you might get hold of. So I would suggest, certainly for pastors, and probably for any Christian in general, Memoirs of an Ordinary Pastor is an excellent and countercultural book to read.
That was a very moving book. I read that as well. Yep. Well, let's push on. A bunch of questions about Calvin. Someone would like to know if you could pronounce his name in French, how it originally sounded. Would you know that? Or?
His name was actually Cauvin. C-A-W-V-I-N, and he changed it and Latinized it to Calvinus.
Sort of in Cauvin?
Cauvin, probably. I guess.
Jean Cauvin?
My French is 20 years old, and I have the linguistic ability of the typical American stroke British person. So I'm guessing Cauvin.
Could either of you tell us what you know about Calvin's conversion? Someone was interested in that. I've only seen myself very brief reference to that.
We don't know much about his conversion. Part of the problem, of course, is that the language of conversion in the 16th century and before, when somebody talks about a conversio, they're generally talking about the move from being a secular person to joining a religious order. So we don't really have the linguistic categories that we have today. Calvin does tell us, I think it's in his preface to his commentary on the Psalms, that his conversion was subito. That's the Latin word he uses, which could mean sudden in the sense of Damascus Road suddenness, or more likely, the Latin word more likely means unexpected, in which case it tells us nothing about the timing of his conversion at all. But sometime in the early 1530s, he moved towards a commitment to the Protestant faith. I suspect it was a process. I suspect as well his background as a humanist meant that he moved to Protestantism when he realized that humanism couldn't deliver the goods for him. But unlike Luther, who tells us too much information about his private life and his development, Calvin only gives us glimpses. And he does talk about a subita conversio. But it's difficult to know exactly what he meant by that, because the language is very obscure, really.
Sometimes scholars put it around 1530, directly before the cop incident that Carl talked about last night, because it seems the cop rectoral address seems to commit Nicholas Cop, and by implication Calvin, to Lutheran-type themes, even though it was still within the Catholic orthodoxy. It seemed to be a break from Catholicism and more in a Protestant direction. And so 1530 seems to be, for some scholars, a potential date, but it's hard to know.
I would disagree, partly because the Cop address does contain quite a bit of Catholic theology, and also because we find Calvin after 1530 counseling nuns and not saying to them you need to leave the church, but counseling them about their vocation. So even our disagreement here, I think, shows the complexity of trying to the date and the time. We will never know.
Someone wanted to know where to start reading in Calvin for a novice, particularly the Institutes. Particular edition they should start with?
The Battles Translation.
Battles Translation,
which is
published by
Westminster Press.
Two volumes.
I call that the NIV version. Scholars have a list of disagreements with the way that Battles translated certain things, but you're going to have that with any translation.
Sure. Yeah.
And it's definitely the most accessible version out there. In terms of place to dip in, I think dipping in at Book 3 and starting with Book 3, Chapter 1, where you start with Union with Christ, that's a good place. The other place is Book 3, Chapters 6 to 10, which I mentioned last night.
The Golden Book of the True Christian Life.
That's a wonderfully accessible beginning point for someone who's just wanting to read Calvin. The other place, though, they're a little bit ponderous, and Carl may think otherwise, but a place I recommend is the Sermons. It's the same way with Edwards as well. Sometimes reading the sermons is a good way to get something accessible for people to read Calvin. So that would be my take.
Yeah, I would say I would affirm everything Sean said. Maybe the reply to Sadoleto gives you a good example of his vision for reform. The other place to look would be to look at the prayers at the end of his lectures. Or at the end of his sermons. You can tell a lot about somebody's theology by looking at their prayers, and they're usually just a few lines long, but there would be a good way into how he thinks.
And those have been collected in a little book called The Devotions and Prayers of John Calvin. So that would be a good place to go.
Was Calvin's Bible the Latin Vulgate? Is that what he used? Someone wanted to know.
Well, he was involved in translation, Bible translation.
Olive Baitan's French translation.
Yeah. Okay.
But also he'd have worked, I mean, he knew Greek and Hebrew and would have worked.
So he'd work in
Greek
the original language.
Oh, yeah. He never, interestingly enough, I don't think he ever quotes Greek or Hebrew in his sermons. And never even talks in highfalutin terms about the Greek word means this. He'll say Paul, the word Paul uses means. But that's interesting on the grounds that he clearly does not, when he's preaching, he clearly does not want to set up unnecessary barriers between himself and the congregation by wearing his learning too heavily on his sleeve. So he never... I said to students at Westminster, if ever I come to hear you preach after you've graduated, never want to hear you quoting Greek in the pulpit, never want to hear you referring to it, because it's just a way of... it's an unbiblical way of setting yourself up above people as a preacher. So Calvin uses Greek and Hebrew, but doesn't quote it in the pulpit. We'll do so in the lectures, but they're different. Mm-hmm. But won't do it from his sermons.
And just an aside, this is a slightly different tack. I mean, Carl has made reference repeatedly to the French editions of the Institutes. And just like with Luther's translation of the New Testament in German really set a mark for the development of the German language, it's the same way with Calvin's, particularly his 1541 edition of the Institutes. People who are French scholars pointed to that as a major breakthrough in the development of modern French prose style. And so that it's interesting that, again, I think it's the influence of humanism. Not only are they quite aware of original sources with Greek and Hebrew, as well as Latin, but they're also the reformers are setting kind of new stages in the development of their own native tongues. Hmm.
King James Version of the Bible would be the English equivalent.
Right.
Back on the sermon, just something occurred to me. Any idea of how long a typical Calvin sermon would have been? Do you preach for an hour, half an hour, 40 minutes?
I think about an hour.
Yeah. Okay.
I notice you have the
8 hour.
Right.
Yeah, it was about an hour. But the interesting thing was is that he would preach all week. He'd preach every day for a week. And he would also rotate pulpits through at least 3 preaching stations in Geneva. And so if he was preaching consecutively during the week, say through 1 Samuel, in order to hear all the sermons, you would actually have to follow him from location to location. And most people didn't do that. So it's an interesting take on consecutive preaching. What does that mean when your people can only show up for one of the 4 sermons or one of the 5 sermons? So,
somewhere in Calvin, perhaps the Psalms commentary, Calvin objects to applying instructions for use of instruments in worship as temple envy. Is there a context we need to understand this? I think the answer is yes, but the details I leave to these guys.
I'm not quite sure what the question is.
You read it.
Okay.
Maybe I didn't get the precise nuance of the question, but or if the questioner wants to just clarify what you're asking.
I mean, it would be very helpful to have the specific Calvin quotation in context to be able to answer. I mean, the typical Reformed argument, of course, and I can't say that this is what is Calvin's mind at this particular point in time, but that instrumental worship was part of the typical worship of the Old Testament that was fulfilled in Christ and was therefore a necessary under the New Covenant and an unnecessary hindrance of reflection upon God, a kickback to the old covenant. So that would be my guess as to what he's thinking about there, but it would be very useful to see the quotation in its proper context and exactly what he was aiming at.
Okay. I'm summarizing now, I'm not quoting, because there were several questions along the lines of Calvinism has a bad reputation. Calvinists are often seen as argumentative, judgmental, hard, the chosen, frozen chosen, and so on and so forth. Which, whether we like it or not, it's pretty hard to argue with that. And I think the question is, what can we do about it? Or how have you tried, perhaps, to deal with that? Is there a way of making Calvinism more winsome? How do we go about that? Can we go about that type of thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think there are ways to being more winsome. And I think part of it it's really been the thrust of what I've been trying to talk about with us over the last 24 hours, is to recognize that the best of the Reformed tradition, whether you look at Calvin or Edwards or the Princeton tradition, puts learning and piety together, so that it's not simply about doctrine, although doctrine is hugely important, and Machen in Christian Liberalism says that Christianity is a way of life based on doctrine. But it's not simply about doctrine. It's doctrine that flows into a changed life. And so at its best, I think the Reformed tradition has done that. Because of the battles that we've had to fight for appropriate doctrine, we end up, the pendulum has probably swung to where we become, like my alma mater has said, specialists in the Bible, which in one sense, that's exactly what we want. In another sense, if that's kind of our self-view, that means we're specialists and you're not, which can ultimately set up that oppositional stance that all too often we're sadly known for.
Yeah.
So, what do you think, boss?
I think I was going to say Sean mentioned his relative youth earlier on. I do want to stress that I don't despise Sean because of his youth. I do despise him, but I have other reasons to despise him. I think part of some of that image is there's a huge amount of cultural baggage that comes with that image. It's just difficult to get out from under. I think in America, probably the kind of literary portraits that men like Nathaniel Hawthorne drew of Puritanism has cast a long shadow over the view of who and what Calvinists are. The Salem witch trials, the way they loom in sort of popular mythology. In the United Kingdom, I think it was the role of Victorian nonconformity that really stifled a lot of the vitality of a more joyous form of Calvinism. So on one level, because there is some truth to the criticism, but some of it is built upon popular misconceptions, yes, and misrepresentations that the best way to repudiate them is not to fulfill the stereotypes that are presented to us. I also think there's and this may be a more sensitive issue at this current time, but I think the church, remembering that it's the church, first and foremost the church, and not getting too involved in sort of political campaigns can be significant, because quite often, as I was saying this morning, in Eastern Europe, the church gives the impression of just being an agent of social protest against whatever's going on, and it creates a negative impression. The church should first and foremost be the instrument, the place where the good news of Jesus Christ is proclaimed. Obviously, Christians are going to have very, very strong opinions on gay marriage, on abortion, all these other things, but our primary mission is to, as the church, is to preach the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. And I think that's a positive thing.
Yeah.
But you know, you're up against you're up against powerful cultural forces that will try to misrepresent you. Mm-hmm. The best we can do is try to avoid giving solid evidence for the truth of those misrepresentations.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the Young, Restless, and Reformed? Any comments on that? What do you see as hopeful in that? Any cautions that you see in that sort of new Calvinist movement?
I think there's much there that gives cause for rejoicing and hope. It's great to see the gospel being preached. It's great to see young people coming to appreciate the doctrines of grace. It's great to see people breaking out from the accidental sort of cultural trappings of traditional Calvinism and being able to combine traditional theology, if you like, with a more culturally relaxed form. What would concern me? I think two things would concern me. One, there's not much talk about the church in it. It doesn't seem to be a very ecclesiastical movement. It's a movement built around parachurch organizations or around particular personalities. And also, there's a certain, like we all do, but Americans particularly like things that work. And there's an element of this looks good and true because it appears to be working.
Mm-hmm.
And it concerns me that mentality, at this particular point in time, that might be good because this is true and it works.
Mm-hmm.
But when it ceases to work, it will still be true.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
But will it still carry the social credibility that it carries at the moment? So that would be my long-term concern.
Uh-huh.
I'm hugely hopeful. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard to imagine a book like that being written 50 years ago before the Banner of Truth Trust started. I think it's humanly speaking, I mean, I think, you know, huge credit goes to Banner of Truth and to Dr. Lloyd-Jones for their leadership about 50 or 60 years ago. So in that regard, it's just a tremendous fruit of that ministry that started really on a shoestring budget. So that it's wonderfully hopeful. I mean, when you get 6,000 people out together for the gospel, you know, with, you know, Ligon, Duncan, and Al Mohler, and Mark Dever, and C.J. Mahaney, I mean, that's just a wonderful thing. And I don't see how we can say otherwise. I think the thing, my biggest concern is we all too often talk about Calvinism as though it's divorced from ecclesiology. But actually, I think Calvin would want to make the argument. Actually, the reason I've narrowed my lecture on the means of grace down to the Lord's Supper is I realized there was no way I was going to be able to talk about all 500 pages in the Institutes in 45 minutes on the means of grace. I mean, for Calvin, ecclesiology is that thing that holds it all together. And that's the missing note, in my opinion. I think the other thing, I mean, I'm a Presbyterian minister, you know, and I think the other thing I worry about is as a Presbyterian, is how little in that book was Presbyterian. On the one hand, I wonderfully rejoice that a lot of the new Calvinism is in Baptist circles, you know, Southern Baptist circles, Baptist General Conference with John Piper, independent circles. That ecclesiology, though, I wonder if that ecclesiology can sustain Calvinism over the long haul. I think Presbyterianism has shown that it can, because it's a church government that really stresses the role of elders generation by generation shepherding God's people and holding true to the doctrines of Scripture. Congregational forms of church government have a greater tendency to go with what's current. I mean, just speaking historically, not making a pejorative or any kind of evaluation. Just as a historian, I would say that. I mean, the Methodization of American Christianity occurs not just in the Methodists, but with the Baptists. That's a book I would love to write someday. And Nathan Hatch has a little bit in the Democratization of American Christianity. So that would be, you know, mm-hmm. They're twin concerns, but an ecclesiological concern particularly.
It's very helpful. Thanks. Sean, a couple questions for you. And again, I'm sort of boiling these down on your leadership forum. Mm-hmm. And, for example, someone said they can see, you were talking about, quote, ordinary people being leaders. Everybody's a
right.
leader. Everybody's mm-hmm. a leader. And the questioner says, okay, I can see how a father and a mother in the home are leaders, but what other ways are people like us leaders? Mm-hmm. Could you just expand on that a little bit?
Well, it's really interesting. I did that. That material is part of a book project that Bob Burns, who's a colleague of mine at Covenant Seminary, and I are working on. We actually did that material over a 13-week Sunday school class at Covenant Presbyterian Church in St. Louis. And the thing that was so striking was how the women in the class reacted. Because they said, you know, for the first time, we are being treated as leaders, as those who lead. And so I had women who lead civic groups, and I had women who were... I had one woman who was a chief nurse in her nursing department, and I had a Bible study fellowship leader. You know, all these women who lead, but we never talk to them as those who actually are involved in leading, and they were just completely enthusiastic. That, to me, was very, very surprising. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things is, I hope we get out of what I was trying to get at, was if leading involves facilitating human growth and flourishing in appropriate ways, then that happens in all kinds of spheres. And it doesn't necessarily require a public or out front office to make it happen. And so distinguishing between authority, which we often tie to office, distinguishing that from leading, I think is an important distinction to make. And so sometimes we tend to think about leading as connected to office, but it's not always that way. I mean, most church planners know that... You may have authority as the appointed evangelist from the presbytery, but there is going to be someone in your core group that is the true chief. They may not have office, but they lead.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and
Okay.